friends, as the first speaker pointed out, the subject of our lecture today is Tao Te Ching, Teachings of Lao Tzu. China, in 5th century BC, produced two great philosophers, Lao Tzu and Confucius. It is said that Lao Tzu was the senior contemporary of Confucius, just like in India, we say that Mahavira was the senior contemporary of Buddha. Now, this was the age of great reformers. In fact, it is called the virtue age, and the rest of the years are called as vulgar age. This was such an era where all over the world great teachers had come. In India, as we said, there was Mahavira and Buddha. In Persia, there was Zoroaster. So also you find in Greece, it was Pythagoras. And in China, these two teachers were there. But history itself shows a little bit of distinction between the work of Confucius and the position of Confucius as well as the work of Lao Tzu. Confucius, the codifier. His work was more akin to that of Manu, the lawgiver, and we find that he was also therefore trying to put straight the ethics and morals which are required for the moral and ethical conduct. And he was trying to provide a kind of a moral foundation to what is called the traditional civilization of China. So the ancient family system of China, as well as the social system, the political system, all of them required a true moral foundation. And that is what he was trying to do. And in this process, history shows that he used to now and then approach Lao Tse, who used to be working as the archivist, the one who took care of the archives of the then king of Chao dynasty. And he used to help him out in trying to get rid of the superstition and wrong kind of rituals, ceremonies, blind beliefs and all that, so that a pure code can come about. And yet, we do find that his position is a step lower than that of Lao Tzu. That the knowledge that he was teaching was more of the intellectual kind, more of the practical kind, more which will help you to lead your day-to-day life along good and right lines. Lao Tzu had a completely different level. It was more geared towards producing a spiritual man. He had more to do with arousing intuitive perception in man, and therefore we find that their very first meeting brings this about. Besides, we will read what HPB has to say, but this is even from a historical point of view, it in a way corroborates what HPB is pointing out. Now, before we see about their meeting, Lao Tse, on the other hand, is said to have been born, like all the great sages, of a virgin mother. Like Jesus, even he is supposed to have had virgin birth. When she was sitting under a plum tree, she gave birth, looking at a meteor in the sky, she gave birth to this child who came from the left side of her body. This is the legend. So much so that it is said that he remained in the mother's womb for 80 years. And when he was born with a full-grown white beard, all symbolic. It just shows that right from the beginning, he had that sagacity and wisdom. That he was born with a white beard and remained for such a long time, it's all indicative of that. Now, we are told that also, he is supposed to have not died, but like Shankara is said to have been disappeared suddenly. So also, it is said of Lao Tzu that he disappeared. At ripe old age, last he was seen at the western frontiers of his Chao province, where he was talking to the custom official who was his great friend, and it seems that this person said that now that you are withdrawing from the world, why don't you put your teachings into writing? And so he journeyed with Lao Tzu, and while journeying, Tao Te Ching was written. And then he comes back and brings these teachings, whereas Lao Tzu is then not heard of after that point. Now, this is a bit of a history of his birth, but as we said, it's interesting to see the meeting of Confucius and Lao Tzu. Most of the commentators, they do bring this about. When first Confucius meets Lao Tzu, we are told that he says, instruct me in the rites and ceremonies, instruct me in something or the other. And Lao Tzu takes a look at him and says, look, a wealthy merchant, he always hides his wealth and appears like a poor person. So also a truly wise man always hides the rich supply of wisdom and appears like a fool to the world. First get rid of your pride. First, get rid of your overzealousness. Now, this may sound like surprising because, after all, Confucius is also put as one of the ethical triad he forms along with Buddha and Jesus. So, in his own right, he is also sage. But it's quite possible to have a tinge of subtle pride, which is seen by Lao Tzu from where he was, from his position. And examples are not lacking. We know how in India there is this story about some sage approaching Gyaneshwar, hearing about his fame that this little boy Gyaneshwar is having all the wisdom of the world, and he used to think he is also equally great. So he goes riding on a tiger to meet Gyaneshwar, and we are told that when he reaches there, he tells Gyaneshwar, who was sitting on a broken wall with his other brothers and sisters, and says, "You come down and meet me. I'm not going to come to you." And it seems that instead of getting down from the wall, Gyaneshwar moves along with the wall. At this, he realizes, no, I can only tame a tiger. This person is really superior person. It's not a question of power, by the way. But here, it was just internally understood that my ego has been discerned by this person. Similar thing happened also with Confucius, we are told in the story. And when he goes back to his disciples, he tells his disciples, "I know fishes can swim, I know birds can fly, I know animals can run. We can catch the fish in a wicker basket. We can catch the birds by shooting arrows at them. We can catch the animals by setting up the traps. But how do you catch a dragon who is rising up and up in the air, bestride on a cloud and air?" Today I met Lao Tzu. Is it possible that he is a dragon? This is coming from Confucius, and students of theosophy will recognize that always a wise man is referred to as dragon of wisdom. So he himself is talking about Lao Tse as a dragon. And how do you catch, how do you understand something which is said in the Dhammapada by Buddha? "No net of desire can catch him. No craving can entangle him. He is a seal of limitless range." How can you catch him? Trackless indeed is he. This is said of the enlightened one. So some similar thing, it's a kind of a homage paid by Confucius to Lao Tse, showing at what level he was. Now if this be the kind of person who is supposed to have been there and his writings are supposed to arouse the intuitive perception, therefore we have to approach his writings with caution. As most of the authors have said, his writings are not open to literal interpretation. Something which is said also about all the great scriptures. Let us turn to notes on the Bhagavad Gita and see what Mr. Judd says in notes. There also he says, "I propose for myself and others that we are going to study Bhagavad Gita in the light of the spiritual lamp. And this lamp, this light can be small or great," he says, "and this light will be fed and increased by" what? "By the Supreme Soul, who will feed it and increase it, provided we listen to its behest, provided we diligently inquire after it." So what is being said is that provided you are keeping yourself nearer to your divine nature, provided you have a diligent inquiry, it is not reading once, reading it again and over again, only then these books yield something to you. It is not as if you read it once and you will get what he has to say. Because he says there is something like disclosed Vedas and there is undisclosed Vedas. So there is reading between the lines. There is going behind the words. And that's why he himself points out in his characteristic style, paradoxical way, which is not there in the handout, but in the pink leaflet it was taken out. In your book on page 141, this appears. "My teachings are very easy to understand and very easy to practice. But no one can understand them and no one can practice them." The great paradox. So long as you try to intellectually appreciate, you cannot comprehend. Something similar is said by Sri Krishna in 9th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Last Sunday our attention was drawn when he says, "This is the kingly mystery and the kingly knowledge. Easy to understand, clearly comprehensible." But what does he say? "Coupled with realization of it, I will make it known unto thee." Its realization can come when? Only when you are in close proximity with Krishna with it. So it is that kind of experiential knowledge. It's not talking about just intellectually or verbally, but experiential, first-hand experience, understanding the very heart of, it is called the way of heart, his teaching. To get that, you have to be near to Krishna. So that's why he says, on the one hand, it is easy to understand, but no one can understand, no one can practice, because no one has reached that inner development which is required. Now this is a sufficiently long background we have given for this, but Tao Te Ching, if we read now what HPB has to say before we proceed to the book itself, we won't read the first one because that's exactly what she says about Confucius, that his was a cold, practical philosophy and that he confined his attention solely to his own country. Whereas for Lao Tzu, she says, he is said to have written 930 books on ethics and religions, 70 on magic, 1000 in all. His great work, however, the heart of his doctrine is the Tao Te Ching, or sacred scriptures of the Taos, has in it, as Julian shows, only about 5000 words, can you imagine, which can be reduced to a dozen of pages. Yet Max Müller finds that the text is unintelligible without commentaries, so that Mr. Julian had to consult more than 60 commentaries for this purpose. Later she says, how during the 4.5 centuries that preceded this earliest of the commentators, there was ample time to veil the true Lao Tse doctrine from all but his initiated priests. Tradition affirms that the commentaries to which our Western sinologists have access are not real occult records, but intentional ways, and that the true commentaries, as well as almost all the texts, have long since disappeared from the eyes of the profane. So this is what HPB has to say. But still, the real teachings have disappeared. What we get is a veiled thing, just like it has happened with all the scriptures. So all the more necessity for trying to see between the lines, go behind the words. What would happen if we take literally Jesus' injunction, don't cast your pearls before the swine? Well, where will we get if you take it literally? Something similar we find. Also, as is pointed out in Fridtjof Capra's book, Tao of Physics, there are two big chapters, small chapters, devoted to Chinese thought and Taoism. There he points out that Chinese thought is something very different. It's not given over to elaborate, logical, abstract, logical thinking. No. That is why, to suit that, the writing of the Taoist teacher, as of Lao Tzu, is a very compact writing, full of suggestive imageries, so that a lot of it gets lost in translation. Because according to most of the commentators, you take one sentence from the original, it is packed with many ideas, and in translation maybe you can come out with two or three ideas, whereas the original would have many more. Now that, it is said, is consisting of 81 chapters. It is, each chapter would have, there are lots of them available, translations, each would have around 2 to 3 aphorisms or 6 to 7 aphorisms and so on. So these 81 chapters are divided into two parts. Up to 36 chapters you have the teaching of Tao, and from then onwards you have teaching of Te. Now what is the Tao Te Ching? Lao Tzu itself, we have to understand the word Lao and Tzu. Lao is old, it is long, and Tzu meaning master. So it is the old master. Just like you have Chuang Tzu, you have Wen Tzu. So Tzu means master. And he was also called Lao Tan. Lao means long. So he was long-eared, like it is said of Buddha and Ganesha, that they have long ears so that they can listen to the woes of people. But they have also long ears because they can hear to the inner voice of the silence. They can hear to the inner Tao. I mean, there are various ways of looking at it. Now, Tao Te Ching. Tao Te Ching. Now, King or Ching, it means classic, it means book, it means treatise. And Tao means many things. In fact, there are 76 different places at which the word Tao is used, and each of them actually is open to different interpretations and meaning. But the very prominent ones are, Tao means way, Tao means cosmic order or rita, Tao means moral principle. But above all, Tao means the impersonal deity, the very Parabrahman or the absolute. And there is Te. Te means virtue, Te means integrity, Te means moral principle. And so what we have is Tao Te Ching means the treatise or the book of way and virtue. There is a lot to it. Just taking these two words, we find that if we turn to Tao, as we said, lots of meanings. Now, Tao, as you see in your handout, the very next quotation gives us some idea. The Tao which can be expressed in words is not the eternal Tao. The name which can be uttered is not the eternal name. Without name, it is the beginning of heaven and earth. With a name, it is the mother of all things. Only he who is eternally free from earthly passions can apprehend its spiritual essence. So this is clearly what students of theosophy would understand as the first fundamental proposition. It talks about the correct God idea. That there is no personal God. God, as Theosophy says, is eternal, immutable, and as Tao, here it is pointed out, unspeakable and unnameable principle. Like the Theosophy school poem says, that it is the unnameable, the one light of all our light, the source, and so on. So, it says Tao, which can be expressed in words, is not the eternal Tao. Now, here the differentiation is made between the undifferentiated, the transcendental aspect of that one reality or Parabrahmam, and the other, which is the differentiated, manifested, Sarguna Brahmam, or the immanent aspect. So, the other one is with the name, to which you can give attributes. The first one is without name, to which you cannot give as attributes. And the first one, which is without name, is the beginning of heaven and earth. Now again, heaven and earth has various meanings. Heaven is the invisible world, it is the noumenal world. Earth is therefore the visible world, the phenomenal world. So, both the seen and the unseen come from that one. What is said in 15th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, that there are two kinds of beings in the world, divisible and indivisible. The divisible is all things, the indivisible is kutastha. But above them, there is a supreme spirit, Paramatma. So here also the words used are, in the original, wu and yu, unseen and seen. They both come from the one source. But what is the mother of all things? It is the manifested logos, it is Ishvara, it is the verbum, from which the phenomenal existence proceeds. And so, we are told that to apprehend the real Parabrahman, you have to be passionless. Now, that would get taken into a different direction, but this is what he tells us about God. Now, another meaning we said of Tao is cosmic order. It is Rita. Now, again, a little bit of a legend is there which says that in the beginning of the world, the Chinese thought points out that there were divine dynasties, there were divine beings, and they had such a power that they could divert the waters back to heavens and make the earth inhabitable for men. They could bring about civilization. Now what is it talking about? It also says that they could do all these things because in their own individual life, they reflected this natural order. So, this is something which we have to understand, which is what Theosophy is pointing out. That the whole of manifestation and evolution, how does it happen? It happens because there is intervention of a great hierarchy of intelligent beings. And what are these intelligent beings? They are able to help in the governance of the natural order of things because they are following the cosmic order. We say that a god is a god because he is Ritavan. He is following the Rita. He is following the law. And in another sense, therefore, we find that this law is an aspect of God. Because Tao is law and Tao is God. And therefore, we do say that God is law. That's what is the second fundamental proposition. And we are told there that this natural order is seen in the universe, in the manifestation, in terms of the law of cycles. The cycle of ebb and flow, the cycle of day and night, and so on and so forth. So that is Tao, which is cosmic order or law. And that's why your quotation says, man takes his law from the earth. Earth takes this law from heaven. Heaven takes the law from Tao. But the law of Tao is its own spontaneity. So there is nothing which is governing that Tao, which is God, because after all, it is only an aspect of God. There is no law which is going to govern it. It is its own spontaneity. Now, if you see, this thing about, they also say that manifestation, we have not brought in a particular shloka here, I mean the aphorism here, but they say that the whole manifestation is continued because of a interplay of two forces, which we say is Purusha and Prakriti, spirit and matter. And they use the word which is very popular, yin and yang. Yang is spirit. It is the bright side. It is the active force. Yin is matter. It is the passive, feminine principle. And we are told that there is a dynamic symmetry of yin and yang. There is that very famous figure where you have a circle and there is a in-between curved line which goes half is dark, half is light, and two dots are there in both the portions. It's very indicative and suggestive, and they say that each of these forces contain a seed of the other force, so that when one force goes to the extreme, when it has already gone to its extreme, it contains the seed of the other force which then takes over. Now this is exactly what happens in evolution. We are told there is pravrittimar, there is nivrittimar. There is involution and there is evolution. During involution you find that spirit involves itself into matter, matter becomes concrete, and then there comes a middle point where there is a kind of a balance. There is a balance between spirit and matter, after which point that seed which is there within that spirit, it takes over. And so it is spirit which asserts itself, and we see that now it is spirit which is asserting and matter becomes ethereal. So this is another way of putting yin and yang, which is a dynamic symmetry. It's a very important point. And therefore, the practical implication of yin and yang is something which is brought out by Lao Tzu by saying that a sage, therefore, when he considers anything in manifestation, as we in theosophy say that in manifestation, duality supervenes. So that when light and darkness are world's eternal ways, there is pain and pleasure, there is good and bad. So when you look at something, don't look at it as if it is the only one absolute thing. Always look at both the poles. Always look at relativity of things. And this is what the sage does. And that's why we are told in the next quotation that there is a same mutual relation between existence and non-existence in the matter of creation, between difficulty and ease in the matter of accomplishing, between long and short in the matter of form, between high and low in the matter of elevation, between before and after in the matter of priority. So take anything you want and you have this duality. So it is not possible for you to consider only one aspect, even positive aspect, without considering the negative aspect. And this is coming in its practical implication, practical moral implication, where Chuangzu, the disciple of Lao Tse, says that shall we honor and exalt only the right and take not any notice of the wrong? Shall we exalt and honor only those who are bringing about orderliness in the governance and take no notice about disorderliness? Such a course we will not be able to pursue. Why? Because he points out, as Lao Tzu points out in the moral principle, that if you would contract, you must first expand. If you would weaken, you must first strengthen. If you would take, you must first give. This is called dawn of intelligence. Some authors have translated this as saying that this is called subtle wisdom of the sage. This is very, very logical and very important, that you cannot know how to contract unless you have understood the process of expansion or something about expansion. You cannot know anything about weakness or about strength if you don't know what is weakness. In other words, when it comes to good and evil, you cannot develop goodness just like that and ignore evil. How? Because, as Mr. Judge points out in letters that have helped me, you must not love vice, you must not hate vice, you must understand it. And as Light in the Path says, that vices of men also become virtues, also become rungs of the ladder, ladder for climbing up to spiritual evolution, one by one as they are surmounted. So vices, if you just ignore it, how will you reach to virtue? How will you reach to goodness? So vices of men also become rungs of the ladder one by one as they are surmounted. And another place, Light of the Path says, that seek out the way. Seek it by testing all the experiences. But he says, by this I do not mean that you will yield yourself to seductions of the senses. What I mean is that you will experience the seductions of the senses, but not feel horror about it. Wait with patience of confidence for that day when it will no longer affect you. And so it is rightly said that a wise man knows more about evil than a good man, than an evil man, because the evil man succumbs to evil, whereas a wise man understands evil. At every point he has encountered evil, gone above it and gone to the next step. So ignoring one pole will not do. You have to understand both the poles. Now this is the very important idea which comes about the two polarities taken to its extreme point in applying to the moral principle. Talking about morality then, it is te, integrity. And like all the other good scriptures of value, even Lao Tzu talks about two kinds of morality, two kinds of virtue. So he says there is a superior te and there is an inferior te. Now, superior virtue is that which you practice without any expectation of reward, without any ulterior motive, without trying to, say, earn merit for practicing that particular virtue, without any pomp or show. That is superior virtue, which is where no result comes back to you. And inferior virtue is where it is completely opposite, that you do it for show, you give out lots of charity because your name appears, you want name and fame, or you want to earn merit, and so on. So superior te, he says, is equivalent to Tao itself. So second chapter in this book is called Tao as a moral principle. So superior virtue is identical with Tao, because after all, what is karma? What is morality? We say that there is no moral law outside of man. What is the true basis of morality? It is within man himself. It is the moral law. It stems from the very being of man. And that's why, in that sense, this moral principle is equivalent to Tao. Now, it is very interesting, therefore, to see that this inferior virtue is not really given much importance by Lao Tzu. And therefore, he says that when I practice virtue unfailingly, I move away from Tao. That means, when I am only concerned with virtue, that I never tell lies, I am a vegetarian, I always give charity, I am not practicing virtue for its own sake, as we shall see more about this, but I am only concerned with being virtuous, in which case you move away from Tao. This is what Light on the Path says. Virtues of men are necessary, not to be dispensed with. What it says is, because when they stand alone and isolated, they create only fair atmosphere and happy future. They can earn you merit, but it is not true virtue. And how? Why this is said? Because, again, as the next one points out, when the great Tao falls into disuse, benevolence and righteousness come into vogue. It becomes a fashion. When shrewdness and sagacity appear, great hypocrisy prevails. It is when the bonds of kinship are out of joint that the filial piety and paternal affection begin. It is when the state is in the ferment of revolution that loyal patriots arise. Now what is being said is that when the great Tao falls into disuse, here you have to take it to mean that when you are not losing sight of the fact that we are all coming from the one source, and therefore there is unity and brotherhood, what philosophy calls as universal unity and causation and human solidarity. When that is not really kept in mind, then what happens? There will be benevolence and righteousness, something which should have been your second nature, you know, like breathing, like your beating of the heart. Humaneness, as HPB says in Five Messages, these are natural qualities of human beings. But in that, when you lose sight of Tao and oneness, it will come in vogue. That means it will be done, it will have to be done deliberately. It will be done for show. It will be done to hide your non-spirituality. It will be like a layer to show that you are spiritual by practicing benevolence. There will be a lot of deliberate generosity and so on. It will degrade, many commentators have pointed out, slowly it will degrade into ritualism. It will degrade into ceremonies and all that. Something which is happening in our day now. So it is very important that the great Tao, because humanness should be practiced for all. It should not be restricted and consciously practiced for a few people. This is what even HPV says in Raja Yoga or occultism, that even the love for your children and wife, it can become a barrier to occultism. And here, Lao Tzu is talking about actually a person who wants to become a spiritual man. He is not talking about a person who wants to become a good man. So for him, this kind of virtue is not enough. When he practices love, he has to practice it for all. When he practices humaneness, it is not for the select few. And that is what is said in Voice of the Silence, when it says, to live to benefit mankind is the first step. To practice the six glorious virtues is the second. Because it is that idea that we are all one, which is going to give direction to practicing of the virtue. That's why practicing of the virtue is the second place. Now, coming to another important point. It is called the doctrine of inaction. Wu Wei, doctrine of inaction, which is something similar. The mistake which is made about it is similar to what is made about Karma Sannyasa Yoga and Bhagavad Gita, where people feel that when they are talking about Karma Sannyasa Yoga, it means you have to be idle without doing anything. But when he talks about inaction, he is not talking about being without any activity, just sitting quietly. In fact, if you go through the chapter which is there, the doctrine of inaction, you find that at least four different things are implied by this doctrine of inaction. One thing, it is the doctrine or the law of least effort. It is the doctrine which talks about non-interference. It is the doctrine which speaks about resist without resistance. And fourthly, it is the doctrine which says, externally you may be inactive, internally you have to be active. So there are four different interpretations at least possible. There could be much more in that doctrine of inaction. Now, the first thing is our law of least effort. You see, we try to bring about things. We do so much of activity to bring about this, that and the other result. And here we are asked, you flow along with the Tao. That is, you flow along with the karma. That whatever karma brings to us, as Mr. Crosby says, don't kick against the pricks. When you are found in a particular situation, do your best. Understand the situation. Do what you can within it, but don't rebel against it. So also it means surrendering the personal will to the divine will, and then what you want to achieve, you will achieve with minimum effort. So don't pit your small will against the divine will. When you try to do that, you have to expend a lot of energy, as it were. The second part, as we said, of the doctrine of inaction is the thing about non-interference. Now this is something Lao Tzu particularly applied to government. Now the first one says, Tao is eternally inactive. We can't see the working of the law, we can't see tangibly the working of God. So the Tao is eternally inactive and yet it leaves nothing undone. Everything is done very, very smoothly. Now second one, as we said, is non-interference. It talks about, in the highest antiquity, the people did not know that they had no rulers. This is talking about the absolutely ideal kind of government. As there is the saying, I don't know who said it, that government is the best who governs the least. So it's something like that. In the olden days, in the highest antiquity, the people did not know that they had rulers. So that's the total non-interference. In the next age, they loved and praised them. In the next, they feared them. In the next, they despised them. There is too much of imposition of laws, as we have not been able to take many of these good aphorisms which are there. But one of them says here that don't have too many laws. If you have too many laws, there will be more robbers and more thieves. So if you don't have laws, if you don't interfere too much, allow people to go along their natural course. And then everything will take care of itself. Govern a great nation as you would cook a small fish. Now this little hilarious statement has always puzzled us, that what is he talking about, cooking a small fish? Like that you have to govern again. The less stirring you do, the better it is. The more you stir, you won't be able to find the fish finally, it will be all smashed out. If you want to eat a whole fish, really, you have to be very careful, you have to be very skillful So also very carefully, very skillfully, you have to govern a large kingdom. This is then carried to the third aspect, which we said it is the resist without resistance. And this applies, there is a chapter even on war. This applies when we are talking about dealing with the opponents. May it be a nation, may it be just a plain opponent. How should we really carry ourselves? Now there is a very, very instructive little story which comes in the Chinese history, where they say that there used to be a person who used to rear cocks for the king. And in rearing this cock for the fight, so after 10 days that he is training this cock for the fight, the king asks him that, is the cock ready for fight? And he says, no, not yet. He's still impulsive and haughty. After 10 days, he says, is he ready for fight? Says, no, he's not still ready, because he still reacts to noises and shadows. If he sees a shadow or if he hears a noise, he reacts violently. Then after 10 more days, he's asked, is he ready? No, he's not ready, because he has still got anger in his eyes, and there is a lot of fight within him. So externally he may look very composed, but there is still fight within him. After 10 more days, and he's asked, is he ready? Now he's just about ready, because I can see that when other cocks crow, he doesn't even react. He appears like a wooden cock. His character, as it were, is whole. And if any other cock comes near, he's going to run away with fright and not even dare to approach. Now, this may sound like, what is he talking about? But it's true. Just like, you know, take a physical example. A man who is a muscle man, who has developed his muscle, and if 4 or 5 people come, he just rolls his sleeves and shows the muscle, and people run away just looking at his muscle. This is developing the inner muscle, shall we say? It is developing the inner strength, inner integrity, developing total harmlessness. You can see step by step, what is he saying? He's got haughtiness, he's got impulsiveness, he's got this. When all that is discarded, that is from your own side, there is total harmlessness. From your own side, there is no provocativeness. Then it is possible to win. And this is not a near utopia. Because one thing, we have the example of both Thoreau and Gandhiji, who did practice non-violent non-cooperation, for which he is very well known, non-violent non-cooperation, achieving without doing much. And there is again a story or an anecdote in the Chinese history, where a boy, a young man, was going to take up an official position, and his uncle was apprehensive that, is he really right and prepared? So he asked that, what if tomorrow somebody is going to strike you, what will you do? And he says that, I will keep silent. What if somebody gives abuses to you? I will keep silent. What if somebody spits at you? Says that, well, I will wipe away the spit. The uncle says, no, that's wrong. If you wipe away the spit, you will create resentment in your opponent and you will provoke him. So not even that much action. You have to just leave it as it is. Now this is, again, as we said, this may sound as very, very utopian, ideal, nothing works like that. But we know that this is the same thing which was said in Bible. He of old said, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you, he who smites you on your left, show him the right cheek. And Light on the Path says that if you don't do this, you are not going to be a spiritual person. He has to surrender all his weapons of offense and defense. He has to become as helpless as a newly born child, as a blind man. So this is a requirement of spiritual life. Whether we are able to do it or not is up to us. So, and lastly, we said about resist without resistance. This is what Mr. Judge, in letters that have helped me, points out. What is meant by this resist without resistance? He said, resist without resisting is the plan of quiet passive resistance. That means, among other things, that too much of expenditure of strength and fortitude is not wise. If one fights, one is drawn into the swirl of events and thoughts instead of leaning back on the great ocean of self, which is never moving. And inactive on the physical plane but active on the inner plane. This is the fourth meaning of the doctrine of inaction, which says, without going out of the doors, one may know the world. Without looking out of the window, one may see the way of heaven. The further one travels, the less one may know. Thus it is, without moving you shall know, without looking you shall see, without doing you shall achieve. This is completely inner training. training the inner man, so that outwardly you may appear inactive, but innerly you are active. That is one other meaning of doctrine of inaction. Now there is another important thing, which is, we won't read the next quotation, which is self-explanatory about warrior and soldier, but there is this other important thing which is called void or nothingness. Now this is what is, again, through the imagery we are brought this out. 30 spokes unite in one nave. The utility of the cart depends on the hollow center at which the axle turns. Clay is molded into a vessel, but the utility of vessel depends on its hollow interior. The utility of the house depends on the empty space. Thus, while the existence of things may be good, it is the non-existence in them which makes them serviceable. So it is seeing the intangible, seeing the non-existent which is behind the existent, tangible, that is one of the meanings. As they say, that it is the unity which is supposed to be something small, which brings about order in multiplicity. It is this virtue of unity in sage which attracts other beings. And also, this void or nothingness is also interpreted that a person who wants to walk the spiritual path, he has to empty himself of wrong notions, empty himself of passions and desires, empty himself of pride, egoism. When he becomes void of all that, then Tao can inhabit fully in him. Something all the teachers have said, as Buddha says, empty the boat, O bhikkhu. When empty, it will go lightly. Or Kabir said it in that one little beautiful sentence when he says, Jab main tha, to hari nahi. Jab hari hai, to main nahi. When I, ego, am there, God is not there. And now, when God is there, I, ego, has to go. So, you have to empty yourself of that pride. So also, there is a lot of unlearning before you can learn. If you come with a lot of preconceptions, you can't learn anything. There is that Zen story where somebody approaches a Zen master and he's so full of his show about what he knows and what he panditya he has. And the Zen master gauges and he asks for a teacup, goes on pouring tea in that teacup till it overflows. And then the person looks at him and says, what are you doing? He says, this is how you are. I cannot teach you. You are so full of your concepts. Unless you empty, unless you get rid of them, I cannot pour something new and the right ideas. So this is the void or nothingness. Maybe we can stretch it even more. And more than anything, it is what is said, behind the personality is the real thing. What HPB, through a very beautiful imagery in the Secret Doctrine, points out, that the quartz has its value because there are atoms of gold behind it. So also, the phenomenal universe has value because there is one reality which we are not able to see. Tena vina pranayam apina chalati. Without that, not even a blade of grass can move, but we can't see that. And that is what is the nothingness or void which we have to take care of. Now, then we are told something about the law of karma. In a very beautiful rendering, this is not the rendering from this particular book. This is from some other translation we have picked up because the language is very good there. And to take the place of, supposing that people are afraid of death, and we can seize and kill the unruly, who would dare to do so? There is always the great executioner. And to take the place of executioner is like handling the hatchet for the master carpenter. He who handles the hatchet for the master carpenter seldom escapes the injury to his hands. Now this is like saying, don't take the law of karma into your own hands. That if you find somebody who is erring, who are you to judge him? One, when can we become like the all-seeing law? It is said that the law of karma takes into account not just the physical action as you see, that the man has murdered or the man has lied, but it takes into account the motive for the action, the inner state of the person at that time, whether he was provoked, whether he was angry, whether he was tired, the burden of his past karma, all these is taken into account by all-seeing law of karma. Can we take the place of that law of karma? And again, if you mete out punishment, are we sure we will mete out the right punishment? Law of karma punishes in such a way that the man can learn the lesson. it is reformative, it is not curative. Can we really do that? So it is as presumptuous as taking into our hand the hatchet of a master carpenter. You should have the skill and knowledge how to use that particular hatchet. If you don't have that, you will only cut your hand. So also, you can't, if you take the law of karma in your hand, you are only actually making provision for the law of karma to compensate that person. Because law is anyway going to punish him. By punishing him, you are as it were creating the situation for getting a future conflict. So what we are supposed to do? It says, to the good, I would be good. To the not good, I would also be good. In order to make them good. Even if a man is bad, how can it be right to cast him off? Requite injury with kindness. This is all that we are given to do under karma. As Mr. Jat says, what will you have for your future life? Enemies or friends? If you are good to inimical person, one third of enmity will be lessened in every incarnation. So, by doing good to those who are not, you are giving him a chance for becoming good. Now the other two, time will not permit us to read that, but the other two things are talking about the law of sacrifice. When it is said that how if kings and barons can keep the unspoiled nature, the whole world shall yield them lordship over of their own accord, heaven and earth will join and sweet rain will fall. That there is this law of sacrifice, the wheel of sacrifice as Sri Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, which must be kept rotating. Brotherhood and reciprocity. Just as the lower kingdoms are serving us, we should be serving them. And if that is done, then rain, which is going to produce nourishing food, will be produced. There is also last quotation, then other things also, we won't be able to go into all of it. We have just touched upon the basic ideas which are supposed to be mainly associated with Lao Tzu. So each and every aphorism would be very important to study. Because after all, it is a blend of metaphysics and mysticism. It is not simply talking about just the code of conduct or simple virtue. It is mysticism. And mysticism is something which you see when you study Sufism also, that you can't get it by just speaking about it. Unless and until you live it, unless and until you change from within, only then you can get some taste of what that mysticism is all about. There is perhaps 2 minutes for taking up questions. Without seeing and do without actually doing anything. This is the use and development of your inner powers and inner senses. That is the doctrine of inaction.
Inaction.
That is exactly the Gita idea. Well, if there is no question, we have already overshot time. The last quotation is very important because it talks about Lao Tzu's description of what were the philosophers of old were like. The skillful philosophers of the olden time were subtle, spiritual, profound and penetrating. Self-effacing like ice about to melt. Simple like unpolished wood. Like a vacant like a valley. Opaque like muddy water.